I want to also thank you for coming to be out this evening, and not only for coming out, but coming from Kansas City area that I do. I don't know that I've ever had a congregation that has worked as hard to make me feel welcome by bringing in tornado warnings and strong winds and hail in March. That's exactly, or April, that's exactly what life is in Kansas City, virtually every March and every April. So I certainly appreciate that little taste of home that we're getting this evening. We're going to take a few moments this evening to kind of open a subject. And as Larry mentioned, these lessons tonight and tomorrow are set up in a class-type format. This evening there will be some limited response, not as much as tomorrow, but I would tell you that tomorrow's lessons really are pretty critical for response from those that are here, so that we can get some good feedback and try to talk about some of the things that are particularly things that are difficult sometimes to understand in how to fulfill our individual roles from Ephesians chapter 5 and 1 Peter chapter 3. That's what we're going to be looking at tomorrow when we talk about the husband's role and what it is that he's to understand and what it is that the wife is to understand about her role in fulfilling that, so that we can have the kinds of marriages that God would have us to have. Tonight is a little bit more basic than that. Tonight is directed really at one concept that we want to get across, and it becomes a concept that I want to make sure that we take with us. So what we're going to do is we'll look at this concept tonight, and we'll finish with this concept, if the Lord permits us to meet, on Sunday evening. Different lesson, but bringing this concept back into the equation. Jesus was asked on one occasion in Mark chapter, and I didn't turn this recorder on, Larry, I'm sorry about that. In Mark chapter 12 and in Matthew chapter 22, it's recorded that Jesus was asked a question about the greatest commandment. And he was given this question that said, so what is the greatest commandment? They had determined that he reasoned well the things that he had taught. And as they did, they would typically sometimes just put Jesus to some kind of test. They were trying things to trip him up. And Jesus responded to that question, I think a little bit differently than we might have a tendency to respond had we not read his response. We read his response, so we might respond the way he did now. But there's a tendency in us when people say, so what's the greatest commandment of God? There's a tendency for us to say, well, every commandment is equal. I mean, all the commandments are equally important. There is no commandment that is less important, as if you can respond to some or obey some and not respond to some, and not respond or obey to those others. And so we have a tendency to equate that, but Jesus wasn't at all hesitant. Jesus just said, here's the greatest commandment. And what did he say that it was? Do you remember? All right, so in Mark chapter 12, he says, the Lord, your God, he says, is one God. Hear, O Israel, the Lord is one God. And that's the God you're going to serve. And he says, and you shall what? What is it that we have to do? He says, first and foremost, above everything else. He says, you have to love God. Love God with all your heart and your soul and your mind and your strength. In Matthew, he gives a little bit of explanation with that as well that helps us to understand that. Why is it that that is the greatest commandment? What makes it the greatest commandment? What makes it more important than every other commandment? Jesus explained that in Matthew chapter 22. Do you remember what he said? He said, upon these two, because he went on to say there's a second that's like it, love your neighbor as yourself, and upon these two hang, what? The prophets and the law. He said, everything that God had taught to the nation of Israel, everything that he had taught, hung on those two concepts. And if you didn't get those two concepts right, then it really didn't make any difference what else you did get right, because that was foundational. He's not saying that this commandment is important and this one is not important. He's saying this one is more foundational than this one. If you skip this step, there's no way to accomplish what you need to accomplish here. So he said we have to understand our dedication to God is first. I would tell you this lesson tonight, I think, is that way. It's not that it's more important, because the things that we're going to talk about tomorrow with husbands and wives, I think, is critically important. The things that we're going to talk about on Sunday about the covenant and about how we have a successful marriage in the Bible class on Sunday, and what every single marriage needs, and no marriage can survive without, which is the basis of the lesson for Sunday evening, all of those are important. But I think God says if we get the concept right first, If we understand what it is we're striving for, then we are better off as far as getting the direction that God wants us to get in our marriage. And so this is a lesson that is entitled, Finding God in Your Marriage. And I think it becomes very important. Socrates said, by all means, marry. If you get a good wife, you'll become happy. If you get a bad one, you'll become a philosopher. I think that speaks pretty clearly as to what he thought of his relationship. But is that what marriage is all about? I mean, it's about getting a good wife or a bad wife, or getting a good husband or a bad husband. Is that what it's all about? I was listening to Paul Earnhardt preach just last week. He was preaching in Bowling Green, Kentucky, and we were visiting up there, and he talked about the concept of, is it all about finding the perfect spouse? Is there one person out there for you? Is there that soulmate that we sometimes hear about today? And he said, you have to hope that that's not true. Because he said, if your soulmate just happens to be in China, men, you realize you're going to have to search through 500 million women just to find her. It isn't about there's one person out there that is going to fulfill me, but that's kind of the concept we get. I think God takes a different approach toward marriage than that. I love this quote by Gary and Betsy Ricucci. They said, one of the best wedding gifts God gave you was a full-length mirror called your spouse. Had there been a card attached, it would have said, here's to helping you discover what you're really like. I would ask you this. How many of you, after you got married, found out some things about your spouse you didn't know before you got married? Is that pretty true? I think that's true of all of us. I mean, dating is not the greatest way to truly learn somebody, is it? We find out that dating is more like a dance move, in the sense of you're trying to put the best foot forward. You don't always give the truest impression, but when you move in with somebody and you live with somebody 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, you see every side of that person. You learn some things. But more importantly, how many of you learned something about yourself after you got married that you didn't realize before? That becomes a big key in marriage, because what we're going to do this weekend is not try to give you the ammunition to change your wife or to change your husband. You know, the lessons tomorrow are the lessons that I encourage people, if you've got some kind of thick vest, you may want to wear that tomorrow. Those are the elbow throwing lessons. It's like, did you hear that? Did you hear that? You listening to what he's saying? That's not what these are all about. I don't think that's the way God approaches it. When we open up Ephesians chapter 5 and 1 Peter chapter 3 or any other passages, God isn't opening up the scriptures to me and saying, Mark, let me just tell you, here's what you need to do to make Judy what she's supposed to be. He's saying, Mark, here's what you need to do to be what you're supposed to be. He's telling Judy the same thing, but he's telling me, here's what you're supposed to be, and here's what you're supposed to be working on, and that is the nature of what we're going to strive to do as we study this together this week. There's a man by the name of Gary Thomas, wrote a book called Sacred Marriage. And in that book, he talks about discovering some things about himself that he didn't know prior to being married. He said, I was voted most polite kid in ninth grade. I don't know if your school had those kinds of awards. Did you have those awards, you know, most polite, most likely to succeed, those kinds of things? And he said, I was voted most polite. And he said, I thought that was a fair award for me. He said, I felt I was polite. I tried to be kind to people. I responded nicely to people. I was generally a happy person. He said, and would have always thought that they had picked the right person for that award, he said, until I was married. He said, once I got married, he said, I found out how passionately I could become annoyed or angered at the smallest of things. He said, for instance, he said, I found out how passionately angered I could get by someone not refilling ice cube trays. Now, that's probably a bad illustration in an audience of this age group. You may not even remember ice cube trays. It didn't always come out the door. You used to have to actually break it up, you know. And prior to the plastic, remember the old metal handles? Some of you older folks with me? The metal handles you had to pull on. That was the first device where you learned the lesson about touching your tongue to something frozen that was metal. But he said, if you remember those days, you do remember how annoying that was. When you'd go to the freezer, you wanted to fix a drink and you wanted some ice cubes, and you opened it up and there's five or six ice cube trays in there, but there's no ice in any of them because somebody had emptied them, but nobody had refilled them. So he said, I went to my wife and I said, how much do you love me? She said, I love you with all my heart and soul. He said, I don't need that much love. He said, I just need 7 seconds of your love. She said, 7 seconds? I don't understand. He said, I've timed it. 7 seconds is how long it takes to fill one ice cube tray and put it back in the freezer. He said, then I had to ask myself, seriously, have I become that petty? He said, yes, I had. I found out that I could get angered and annoyed by things that never should have angered or annoyed me. I wasn't the big person that I thought that I was. And so that's a little bit what we want to talk about, because that happens when we get the wrong focus. And he goes on in that book, Sacred Marriage, to talk about that, debunking one of the great myths that exist in this country today. Exist in the world probably in a lot of places, but certainly in this country today. The idea of, think even in terms of our nation. Our nation is founded on certain principles, certain inalienable rights, certain things we are guaranteed. We are guaranteed life, liberty, and what? The pursuit of happiness, and there's the problem. We sometimes approach marriage that way. Happiness is not something to be pursued in marriage or otherwise. And what we're going to see tonight is that maybe God has different plans for us than we have for ourselves. We need to get out of the idea of, is marriage going to make me happy? Is marriage going to make me more happy? As we watch advertisements, as we watch the depiction of marriage in movies and in other things that we watch, we see that it seems to all be about what is it that makes me, what is it that makes me happy? How do I achieve that? What is it that my wife can do to make me happy? What is it, from her viewpoint, that I can do to make her happy? And we see marriage that way. Think about a typical meeting of a couple as they're heading toward marriage. Young woman sees a guy and she just falls in love. I mean, he comes into her life and he's treating her so wonderfully, and she just pictures him as being this knight in shining armor that is going to swoop down on that gallant steed of his and reach down and grab her up and throw her on the back of the horse, and they're going to ride off into the sunset. And she thinks he's going to fulfill all my emotional needs and he's going to supply the things that I need, and we're just going to have a wonderful life together. And then, you know, and then he gets down on that knee and opens that box and drops that rock, and the next thing you know, they're engaged, and they're professing their enduring and everlasting love before a host of other people who are witnessing that. And it's not much different for him. Slightly, maybe. He thinks, she's the most beautiful woman that I've ever met, and I just can't wait to be able to be married to her so that she can greet me at the door with the remote and slippers and take care of fixing dinner. And hopefully the men aren't really that selfish. But we have this idea of a picture of marriage. But then what we find is, when we get married, that at some point, it may be a few months down the road, it may be a few years down the road, but at some point, there is a period of disillusionment where I realize that it isn't exactly what I thought it was going to be. That there's significantly more work than I thought there was going to be, and all the happiness that I thought it would bring me doesn't just happen in the way that I thought it was going to happen. And so what we do is we start to get a little bit better picture of marriage. And what we need to understand is, what is it for? I mean, if somebody asked you that question, what is marriage for? How would you respond to that? Because biblically, there are a lot of things that God talks about. Somebody tell me, give me one reason for marriage, one thing that marriage is for. I'm sorry, what? It does teach us, no question about that, and we're going to talk about that specifically this evening. Great concept of marriage. Other things that marriage is for. Companionship. In the very beginning, God saw man. It was the only part of his creation that he didn't address as good, wasn't it? He saw man, and man was alone, and he said, that's not good. Need man and woman together. There was a companionship, and he talked about a oneness of flesh, and there's much more in that oneness of flesh than just the sexual union, but that's involved in that as well. And so marriage is also for the proper fulfillment of sexual union, is it not? God intended it to be that, and he intended that to be an enjoyable or pleasurable part of marriage as well. He created that. We didn't make that up ourselves. God created us that way. Other things. Oh, let me get from Larry first, and then I'll go back toward the back. What did you say? A place to serve. As we start thinking about, now I've got a role to fulfill, what is it that I want to do? I've got a good friend whose son, I have to tell you, I'm so thankful that his son proposed way after I proposed. You know, because, and I sometimes even hate to tell this story, because if you're not married yet, it just sets the standard way too high, I can tell you. He hand-carved a wood box like a jewelry box for the girl that he was going to propose to. Carved the top of it, very ornate work that he did on that. Fixed her a nice dinner one evening, presented her the present along with the engagement ring in the jewelry box. And as he was doing that, went over to the kitchen area. He had prepared a large pan or bowl of water and draped a towel over his arm and went over and got down at her feet and removed her shoes, started to wash her feet, which she was just shocked. And his question to her was not just, will you marry me? He said, will you allow me to serve you as your husband for the rest of your life? That's beautiful. That's damaging to all the rest of us. But it's beautiful. But it marriage is a place to serve. What was it said in the back? I heard somebody. Absolutely. There are things that God uses within marriage to help us get to heaven. I mean, there are a lot of purposes in marriage. It's also intended for God not only for the sexual union, but also the propagation of the race, isn't it? I mean, he intended that we multiply and that we do that through marriage. What we do need to understand is that it is not happiness. Happiness is not the goal. Not even here on earth is happiness the goal. It never has been the goal that God gives us in marriage or, I think, in any other aspect of life. Turn in your Bibles to Matthew chapter 5 for just a moment. This is not a passage on marriage at all, not the section of Matthew chapter 5 we're looking at. But it's a passage that we're familiar with. A section we call the Beatitudes. And each of those Beatitudes starts with the same phrase or the same word, which is blessed. And we understand that to mean what? Blessed means what? It means happy. I mean, true happiness, right? Contentment, the kind of contentment that God says that we should have. Not a superficial, giddy kind of happy, but real joy, the kind of joy that Jesus prayed that be with his disciples, that they had the kind of contentment, the true joy in life that he had. And so each one of these starts, but never is it something that is pursued. He says what? Blessed are, first he says who? Blessed are who? First, he says, the poor in spirit. Blessed are the poor in spirit. Verse 4, blessed are those who mourn. Blessed are the meek. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness. Blessed are the merciful. Blessed are the pure in heart. Blessed are the peacemakers. What we find out is that God's plan for happiness is never to pursue happiness as a goal. It doesn't matter if we live in a country that says that's one of our inalienable rights or not. If you're pursuing happiness, you'll never achieve it. It is a non-attainable goal, because it's not really intended to be a goal at all. Happiness is the byproduct, or it's the result of a life properly lived. And I think what we're going to see from Ephesians chapter 5 and from 1 Peter 3 and some other places is that God says, if you want a happy marriage, a truly fulfilling marriage, a marriage that is the closest thing on earth to the relationship that exists between you and your God in heaven, he says, here's all you have to do in order to accomplish that. Be the kind of husband that God tells you to be. Be the kind of wife that God tells you to be. Strive to become the person God says you should be if you want to attain the goal that God says you can attain. It's kind of the same concept of sometimes I think we misplace heaven. As if what I'm striving for is heaven. I think what I'm striving for is to live a life that is serving God and pleasing God, and what he has promised me is that I'll receive heaven for that. That's still more of a goal. If I think in terms of striving for heaven or striving for happiness, I'm striving for a goal that becomes at least somewhat self-centered. If that's my main goal. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that we're not trying as hard as we can to get to heaven, but we're doing it by doing what God has asked us to do. And he's made these promises to us. I'm not trying to get to heaven so that my life will be good. I'm trying to live for God because of what God did for me. And he says, because of that, I'll take you home for eternity. That's a promise. That's a byproduct. That's a result. And I think marriage is the same way. that God would have us understand marriage is very much something that we are striving to become better at, becoming the most godly husbands we can, the most godly wives we can, so that we can attain or gain the happiness that he says comes there. I mean, Jesus was not only a man who was content and full of joy, and he prayed for his disciples that their joy might be made full, like his joy. But he was also called a man of what? He was a man of, you remember, sorrows and acquainted with grief. I mean, the circumstances of Jesus' life. Do you think the circumstances of Jesus' life were very conducive to happiness as a goal? Or did he have joy in spite of circumstances? And I think that's because of who he was, because of the life that he lived. It wasn't because the circumstances were all right around him. Even those that were closest to him all turned their back and walked away from him, and yet he still had joy and fullness of joy because he was fulfilling the will of his Father, living the way God said. And God said, if you live the way I tell you, you can have the joy that I've spoken about. So I would like us to think in terms more of happiness being the end game. It's something that we're going to get as a result. And if I'll change my goal, I can probably change what I'm attaining in that goal. And so the question is, what if God designed marriage to make us holy more than to make us happy? What if that's the design behind it? That God didn't intend that marriage just be easy and that no work be involved. I mean, Christianity. How many of you would say, you know what, Christianity is a breeze. It doesn't require any effort at all to be a Christian, does it? I mean, that's crazy. We know it's hard. It isn't easy to live the life that God asks us to live all the time. And people are bombarding us with all kinds of ideas and all kinds of thoughts and all kinds of actions. People mistreat us. It isn't an issue of easy. So much so that James told us, count it as part of your joy when you have trials. A good friend of mine, before he got married, another friend of ours preaches now as well. This is when we were down at Florida College. And Ralph, who's outside of my wife, my best friend on this earth, Ralph Walker, if some of you probably certainly know Ralph, but Ralph had already proposed to Paula. And this other good friend of ours who was later to become a preacher, I remember us sitting around, the three of us were talking one day, and he said, I've been praying for you, Ralph. Ralph, as is usual or typical with him, if you tell him that, he's going to ask you. He says, what have you been praying? You know, and he wants to know, what have you been praying on my behalf? This gentleman said, I've been praying that you and Paula have sufficient troubles in your marriage. You know, I'm thinking, look, I don't need this guy around when I get married. Not going to help me. And Ralph was a little puzzled by that, but this guy went on to say, you'll never grow strong in your relationship if you don't have any trials. And so I'm going to pray that you have sufficient troubles to grow strong in your relationship with each other and with the Lord. Great concept. Not many newlyweds think in those kinds of terms. I always ask married couples to when I'm going to marry them, couples that are engaged, I say, write me down the three reasons you want to marry this person. I've never yet had anybody say, you know what, because I think this person's going to test my patience. And I really need to grow in patience. We don't think in those kind of terms. We want it all to flow easily, but we know that it's not going to. And I think God has designed marriage, to, as we mentioned a minute ago, to teach us some things. And so as we think about marriage, what happens is we get the wrong idea. You got to remember that romance is a relatively modern pursuit from the standpoint of the way that we view that. I mean, don't you just love the romantic story of Isaac and the engagement and all they went through as they drew close to one another? Wait, that part's all missing, isn't it? He saw her, he took her as his wife, and they went in together. That happened biblically a lot. That happens today a lot in other cultures. In Western culture, we've got this whole courtship idea that goes with it. Romance is not the foundation of marriage. I'm not telling you it's not a part of marriage. We'll see that tomorrow. Those that would tell you, you know, all we have to do is just love, like agape love, you don't really need to romance, miss the point of what's said in Ephesians 5, I think. God says, no, both are parts of marriage, but you can't found it, you can't base it on the concept of romance, and there's a reason for that. Because if you set it on romance, you've got something that just can't accomplish the goal that you're trying to accomplish. It can't endure on romance and feelings. Why is that? Why do you think marriage can endure on love, true love, agape, cannot endure on romance and feelings? They're not always there. How many of you in here have multiple children? Let me see your hand. How many of you love your children as much as you can possibly love them? You'd say, you know what, I love my children with all my heart. Well, that's a little scary. Only half of the hands that said they have children. You understand, that's kind of a rhetorical question. If you raised your hand to the first question, it should automatically go up for the second. Yes, I love my children. How many of you would say, though, there are times when I'm not real fond of my children? I don't like my children. I'm ready to wring my children's neck. You know, that kind of thing happens. Why? Because that's the emotional side, and the emotional side isn't always consistent. It doesn't always stay there. And so it can't be the basis for a marriage relationship any more than it can be the basis for my relationship with God. If my basis for my relationship with God is purely emotional on my and His end, then we're in trouble. You have to believe there are numerous times, I know in my relationship with God, there are numerous times where God could say, I got to tell you, I'm not real happy with you right now, Mark. I don't really like you right now. I don't like the things that you're doing. He has still loved me without ever wavering in that at all. But I haven't always pleased Him emotionally in all the things that I've done. He uses terms like grieving the Holy Spirit. Sometimes you grieve God because we choose to do things that are wrong. It can't be based on the emotions and the feelings, and that's because they're constant. There's no elasticity to romantic love at all. It doesn't really stretch, and it needs to stretch. The kind of love needed to sustain a marriage needs to stretch. Think of the relationship of God and Israel. Think of the relationship of God and us. Think of your own marriage. I've been married for, it'll be 34 years in May. And there has to be some stretch. Every brick in that road that we have walked over those 34 years has not been exactly the same. Sometimes are harder than others. There's conflict in marriage. We're not specifically talking about a lesson about conflict this weekend, but we do sometimes. We talk about that conflict is just a part of marriage. You can't avoid that. It takes some stretch in marriage to accomplish what we need to do. And so what we find out is when you strive for happiness, you strive for the wrong goal. More importantly, when you strive for happiness from our spouse, we strive from the wrong goal from the wrong person. Why is that? Why is that? Where is my true joy to come from in life? It comes from God. And if it comes from my spouse, and I have to tell you, please don't get the wrong idea here, because Judy for 34 years has made me wonderfully happy. But if I am dependent on a person to be the source of my happiness, I am setting myself up to be let down. But God will never waver. Everything He has ever promised me, He will fulfill. Everything He has ever indicated about my life, He will come through on. He will never fail. He'll never let me down. He'll never turn His back. He'll never say the wrong thing. He'll never act the wrong way. Why? Because He's God. And that has to be the source of my happiness. So as we think about that, I want you to think about a couple of concepts and a couple of passages with me. Analogies that are made in the Bible. Because I think it is fascinating the way that God uses this subject to address some truths about Him. And what we find out is that marriage does teach us truths about God. And I don't think that's coincidental. I don't think it's just some kind of wordplay that God uses. I think there's very intentional purposes behind all of that. God doesn't just pick words for the sake of picking words. It's His way of communicating with us. We understand that. Think in terms of, this to me is a great example of this concept. The most common reference that we make regarding our relationship with one another is the one word used in the Bible that has the least meaning of all the words that are used to talk about our relationship. If we're talking about our relationship one with another, we are normally referring to ourselves as what? All of us together. As Christians, we compose. We should know that. Wouldn't you most likely hear the church? I mean, we talk about ourselves as the church. Isn't it interesting that that's the word we use overwhelmingly more than the others, and it means the least? I mean, it just means a called out. So generic is the word that God uses it in Acts to talk about a mob assembly that is gathered. If the word doesn't have something attached to it to tell you what they're called out of or into, it really doesn't mean much of anything. But we use that most frequently. But give me other names he uses to refer to us. The saints. Why saints? Why you choose that word? There's the idea of holiness and set apart. The word means something, doesn't it? He wants us to understand that set apart nature. Other things. Children. Why use the word children? Why would you use the word children? Why would he even refer to us as his children? Talks about a relationship with him, a familial relationship, doesn't it? I mean, you think about what John said in 1 John chapter 3 when he says, "Behold, what manner of love the Father has given unto us, that we should be called his children." I mean, that's an incredible thing. He said, "I want you to understand what it means to be a child of God." He calls us brothers and sisters with one another. He calls us the family of God or the household of God. He calls us the body of Christ. You know, we talk about being members of the church. Those words they don't even belong together. I mean, I understand what we mean by it, but members are of the body. There's a meaning behind member. You know, you used to be able to, probably still can, but you could get insurance for dismemberment, like if you lost an arm. That's what it meant. Part of my body was removed. Dismemberment. Member, he talks about a body because he's trying to help us understand the nature of functioning together, isn't he? All of those words mean something. I think he does the same thing in our relationship with him. I want you to look at a couple of passages with me as we think about this relationship. In Hosea chapter 2. Hosea chapter 2. God views his people as a husband views his wife. That's what he says. And in verse 16, we read, "In that day declares the Lord, you will call me my husband. You will no longer call me my master." In verse 19, he says, "I will betroth you to me forever." Did God cease to be their master? He says, "You'll no longer call me master." Why? Because was he no longer their master? Sure, he was their master. He didn't cease to be their master, did he? He's saying, "But I want you to view a different relationship than that." And that's an easy one to understand. If I am the slave and he is the master, that carries one connotation with it. But if he says, "I am your husband, and you are my wife. I want you to call me husband." I get a whole different picture of the relationship I have with God. That isn't just coincidental. I think he's wanting us to understand something about the nature of marriage. He tells us also in Isaiah chapter 62, just a great passage where he talks about God rejoicing in his people. In Isaiah chapter 62, verse 5, I love this passage, I have to tell you. I get such imagery with this. He says, "As a bridegroom rejoices over his bride, so will your God rejoice over you." 34 years ago almost for us. And I can still remember to this day what I felt like standing in the front of a building similar to this, but watching the doors open in the back in the center of that building and watching my wife turn the corner and start down that aisle holding on to the arm of her father. I can picture that as vividly today as if it was happening today, because I remember the excitement that I felt when she turned that corner. And, you know, back in those days, and I know it's not always done now, but that's the first time I'd seen her that day. You know, and so she walks around the corner and she's in that wedding dress, and your heart just skips a beat. It just unbelievable. You're thinking, this is the greatest day of my life so far. I thought maybe I blacked that out. I pushed a button I didn't mean to push. And so as I thought about that, I thought, this is just incredible. God said, "You know how you felt, Mark, when you saw her walking down that aisle? That's how I feel about my people. You know, other people may not notice. Other people may not delight in her the same way, but I'm telling you, I I rejoice over my people like a bridegroom over his bride. Man, that means something to me. That helps me understand something about my relationship with God and how he views me, because I can see it even through something that I've experienced myself in this life. Jesus uses that same imagery, doesn't he? He talks about being a bridegroom, talks about a wedding banquet when he talks about the kingdom of heaven, or you talk about the marriage of the bride in the book of Revelation, or it's used in the opposite side of that as well. The prophet Jeremiah likened Israel's idolatry to adultery. We're told the same thing in Mark chapter 8. He talks about an adulterous generation. You should be married to me, he says. You should be dedicated to me, but you're going some other direction with your life spiritually. He relates that to adultery. He says, I want you to understand you're cheating on me. He wants us to get that picture. And I think what we need to understand is that there are things that I can learn about God. That it isn't just ruminating on these analogies or these words, but that God has very, very definite intents. Maybe I did push something. That will not advance for me now. So, we may just have to give up on that projection for the rest of the... Oh, there we go. See, very much like a marriage. Sometimes it works the way you want it to. Sometimes it's a little temperamental. Marriage is just this divine picture of reconciliation. And much of what I can help other people to understand about God is understood through marriage. I want you to turn to Ephesians 5 with me. We're going to start not at the beginning of that passage, because that's where we'll be tomorrow. But I just think this is just great what Paul says to these brethren in Ephesus. Because if you hear a lesson preached on marriage, it's almost always going to somehow or another get back to Ephesians 5, because there are such great things that are said there. But it's interesting, because Paul gets to the end of it, and he said, you understand, I'm not talking about marriage. I mean, I understand, these are truths about marriage, and we'll show those truths tomorrow, Lord willing. And God intends us to follow him. He's not using an example that's false to make a point that's true. He's using an example that's true. But he says, please understand, all this discussion about husbands loving your wives and wives submitting to your husbands and all the things that he said, we're not talking about marriage. Look what he says in verse 32. This is a great mystery, but I speak concerning Christ and the church. Nevertheless, do what I told you to do. But he says, that's not really what we're talking about. We're talking about the relationship that God has with his people, the relationship that Christ has with his church. And so it's not an issue of what will make me happy, but rather what it is that will make God happy in this relationship. And so I'm striving to make sure that I've got the right goal in all of this. The goal in marriage, as in all of life, as Paul calls it in 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 9, is to please God. That's the goal. Let me tell you why that's so important. Why God gives us this incredible picture, because he's saying, Mark, when you look at marriage, you ought to be able to see something about what it means to have a relationship with me. You ought to understand something about what it means to have me as your God, to have me as your husband, for us to be joined in this relationship. And the reason that becomes critically important is because that is the picture that I'm giving to the world. And I think this is why this becomes so foundational. Everything our three sons understand about the nature of faithfulness of God is learned first by watching their father in his relationship with their mother. Everything they understand about reconciliation is learned as it is filtered through this relationship that they see first on earth. Everything that they understand about any aspect of their relationship with their God, with their Father in heaven, everything I'm trying to teach them, God has said, my marriage is supposed to be the demonstration of that, so they can grasp that concept. And I would tell you that becomes absolutely critical. Ralph Walker taught me the gospel. We were best friends, from early on in high school on up. He taught me for 3 years. Tried to teach me for 3 years. I was a little thick sometimes, a little stubborn sometimes. I played a lot of sports. I knew that if I committed to God, I was going to have to alter my schedule and some other things. And some of it was just the last year, I can tell you, was not that I didn't understand truth. I just wasn't willing to give up my life. And I knew to commit to God meant I've got to change some things. I didn't have to give up everything I'd ever done, but I had to make some changes in the way I handled things. Wasn't willing to do that. But that wasn't the biggest difference maker in my life. I came from a totally dysfunctional home. Abusive at all levels. Alcoholic that ended up going into divorce and all that goes with broken home and all of those kinds of things. And I don't say that to get your sympathy for me. That's totally a non-issue. God's graciousness has so exceeded that in my life that's not the issue at all. But what the issue is that I used to spend plenty of time over at their house. And I saw his mother and his father and the relationship they had as a husband and a wife, and it was something I had never seen before. And I saw the relationship that they had as a father and a mother to those two children. It was something I had never seen before. And God says, you know what? We ought to be living our lives in such a manner that we are ready to give an answer. And I always thought that was an interesting quote. When we're told, be ready to give an answer, implies that somebody's asking a question. You ever think of that? To be ready to give an answer doesn't just mean, you know what, you need to be ready. It's indicating to you, you're living in such a manner that somebody's going to want to know why. Their life was so different. I needed to know, what was it? What was the element in his life that was not in my life that made them who they were? And it was when I recognized that it was God that changed their life, that made their life, I understood something about that. And so everything that other people see, they're getting a picture not only of Judy and me. People are getting a picture of God through our marriage. And it's going to either be a good one or a bad one based on how we demonstrate that. But they're looking at our lives for that. And when I can demonstrate to them that marriage can be what it is supposed to be. We've got, as I mentioned, the three sons. They're all three married. What is the greatest testimony I can give them to the success of God's design of marriage is to let them see their parents remain strongly married and dedicated to God. We need to give them that example. And God's saying, it's a matter of you've got to find God in your marriage first for it to succeed. So one of the reasons that I'm determined to keep my marriage together is not because it makes me happier, though it does. There's no question about that. It's not because I want my kids to have a secure home, even though they've moved on in their own life. I do. It's not because I want them to have a secure home, but I do. I want them to be able to come home at any time and know that they can come into a home of people that love God and love each other. It's not because it would tear me apart to see Judy have to start life all over again, but it would. I mean, as I've watched that happen in people's lives, including my own growing up, you watch that, it is just destructive, and it would tear me apart to see her have to go through that. But that's not the reason. The reason I want my marriage to stay together is because I want the world to know God was not wrong when he established marriage. That God said it can and will work, and it can be blissful and can be glorious, can be happy for us as it is glorifying him. I want them to see that picture. And I think it's important that they see it. That's why I want to make sure that I'm staying together. Because my life should be all about the glory of God. And God has said, I've now given you, because you're married, I have given you a relationship wherein you can portray my relationship to my people, to all the world around you. Isn't that a great thing? I mean, you talk about a privilege. That God would say, I want you to take your life and show people how wonderful it is to be married to me. That's why it's foundational. So this weekend isn't about how I can be happy. It's about how I can be holy. Because if every one of us looks at the lessons tomorrow and Sunday and says, how do I become the most holy husband, the most holy wife, whether I'm married now or if that's what I'm striving for later in life? If I can become the most holy wife, the most holy husband, I would tell you, you're going to have a marriage that's happy. There is no question about that. God has promised that. But he says you'll also have a marriage that brings great glory to him. And there is no greater thing we could do than bring glory to God in our marriage relationships. That's more foundational. That's a little more serious than some of the things that we'll talk about tomorrow when we talk about some of the practical applications of how to love and how to submit and the things that God wants us to do. But I think if you establish the foundation, it gives us the right goal to strive for so that when we start throwing the elbows tomorrow, that we're not afraid to take them back and say, you throw it back because I need to know who I am. No greater thing your spouse can do for you than to truly be a mirror so you can see what you are before God. That's a great wedding gift for somebody to help you see who you truly are. Not pleasant, but a great gift because it makes us who we ought to be. Thank you guys so much for your attention this evening. I appreciate that. If the Lord allows us to, we plan on meeting tomorrow for those lessons as well.